Nemoto presents Addiction, the Synthetic Era. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 21 minutes. The 2010s introduced a decisive shift in the risk environment for drug use. Synthetic opioids, principally fentanyl and analogs, overtook heroin in many regions, not because demand suddenly expanded, but because supply changed. Small volumes of highly potent material became easier to produce, conceal, ship, and mix. Trafficking networks favored compounds that delivered profitability in grams rather than kilograms. The result for end users was instability. Unpredictable potency, rapid onset, short duration, and frequent admixture with non-opioid substances. Mortality followed the instability. Communities that had struggled with opioid dependence for years now confronted a different hazard. Not just dependence, but poisoning. Several features distinguished the synthetic era from prior waves. First was potency. A tiny error in mixing could produce a dose far beyond tolerance. Second was volatility. Street formulations changed week to week, sometimes day to day, defeating informal dosing rules learned over years. Third was diffusion. Fentanyl and other synthetics appeared not only in heroin but also in counterfeit tablets pressed to resemble legitimate medications, and in supplies of cocaine or methamphetamine where no opioid was expected. Fourth was speed. Onset accelerated and windows for rescue narrowed, demanding faster recognition and wider distribution of reversal agents and oxygen. Fifth was polydrug interaction. Sedatives and alcohol amplified risk in combinations that were not always deliberate. The supply side evolved for structural reasons. Precursor chemicals were easier to move across borders than bulky agricultural products. Production could occur closer to final markets and be adjusted quickly to enforcement pressure. Pill presses and tableting blends allowed counterfeit products that mimicked regulated medications closely enough to mislead even experienced observers. Inexpensive test batches could probe demand and inform adjustments without large sunk costs. Enforcement agencies confronted a hydra. Each cut head replaced by new analogs and alternate distribution channels. For individuals, the practical consequence was uncertainty. A bag that looked familiar might contain a different compound or ratio than the last purchase. A tablet stamped like a known brand might deliver several times the expected dose or an entirely different pharmacology. People without established opioid tolerance, including those who primarily use stimulants or sedatives, faced risks they did not recognize. The phrase accidental opioid exposure entered local vocabularies as coroner reports tied deaths to substances the decedents were not known to seek. Polysubstance use became the norm rather than the exception. Some combinations were intentional, opioids with benzodiazepines to reduce agitation or with stimulants to offset sedation. Others were inadvertent, a function of contaminants and counterfeit pills. Alcohol remained a constant cofactor. Gabapentinoids, prescribed for neuropathic pain or anxiety, appeared in toxicology reports alongside opioids and benzodiazepines. Each additional depressant narrowed the margin of safety. Stimulants introduced separate risks: dehydration, hyperthermia, cardiovascular strain. When stimulants and fentanyl co-appeared, the clinical picture could oscillate between agitation and respiratory depression, confusing bystanders and delaying appropriate response. A further complication emerged from the introduction of veterinary or industrial sedatives into street supplies. Agents without opioid mechanisms still produced deep sedation and introduced tissue injury risks when injected. Naloxone, while essential for opioid reversal, did not address these agents directly. Scenes required oxygen, airway support, and patient warming in addition to naloxone. First responders adapted protocols, but bystander training lagged in many places. Treatment programs confronted new patterns. Inductions onto buprenorphine or methadone, previously timed to the natural withdrawal curve of heroin, required adjustment for fentanyl's kinetics and receptor dynamics. Low-dose or microinduction protocols became more common to reduce precipitated withdrawal risk. In some settings, higher maintenance doses became necessary to stabilize symptoms. Clinical teams emphasized rapid access, same-day starts, and flexible scheduling to capture motivation at the point of contact. Programs that imposed narrow intake windows or complex prerequisites lost patients in the gap between intention and action. retention emerged as a central metric. Stabilization was not just a question of initiating medication but of preventing dropout during the first weeks, when routines were fragile and exposure to high-risk supply remained likely. Text reminders, transportation assistance, contingency management, and co-located services improved retention. Telemedicine access reduced missed visits, especially for individuals balancing work, caregiving, or unstable housing. Policies that permitted bridge prescriptions and pharmacy-based induction reduced gaps that previously resulted in withdrawal and return to the street supply. Harm reduction organizations altered practice as the supply changed. Naloxone distribution scaled from targeted programs to broad saturation campaigns. Training emphasized recognition of respiratory depression rather than reliance on dramatic stereotypes. Bystanders were taught to expect multiple naloxone administrations and to provide rescue breathing while awaiting response. Oxygen availability at supervised consumption sites and outreach vans increased. Fentanyl test strips and spectrometry-based drug checking expanded where legal frameworks allowed, providing actionable information about potency and adulterants. The message shifted from abstinence slogans to practical steps. Avoid using alone, start with a test dose, carry naloxone, know the signs of non-opioid sedation. Public spaces adapted unevenly. Libraries, transit hubs, shelters, and public restrooms became frequent sites of overdose. Staff in some jurisdictions received training and stocked naloxone. Others adopted restrictive policies that displaced risk without reducing it. Retail and service workers encountered medical emergencies for which job descriptions offered no preparation. Local governments that established clear bystander protocols, installed emergency call buttons, and supported staff training saw faster response times and fewer fatalities on premises. Those that chose punitive approaches saw overdoses move to less visible, more dangerous settings. Carceral settings faced predictable challenges. Facilities that withheld medications for opioid use disorder during incarceration increased the risk of fatal overdose on release. Programs that offered methadone or buprenorphine during detention and coordinated immediate continuation post-release reported lower mortality and better engagement. Screening at intake, initiation for those already dependent, and handoffs to community clinics within 24 to 72 hours after release became recognized components of safer practice. The cost of these programs was modest compared with the costs of emergency response, readmission, and reincarceration following relapse. Housing policy intersected with overdose risk. Individuals without stable housing had fewer options to avoid using alone and less control over setting. Storage of medications, confidentiality at telehealth visits, and attendance at appointments were all harder without a room and a door that locked. Housing first models, which offered shelter without sobriety preconditions, improved treatment retention and reduced emergency utilization. Sober living models helped others but required careful oversight to avoid predatory practices. Communities that invested in both forms, aligned to patient preference, achieved better system-level outcomes than those that chose a single model by ideology. Data systems improved but remained fragmented. Emergency medical services collected overdose call data, hospitals coded admissions, medical examiners recorded deaths, harm reduction programs tracked naloxone reversals, treatment programs tracked engagement. Few jurisdictions integrated these sources into near real-time dashboards. Where integration did occur, outreach could target hot spots, supply warnings could be issued promptly, and resources could be shifted to meet surges. Absent integration, responses lagged behind conditions on the ground. Messaging evolved as well. Public statements that once emphasized deterrence began to include practical information, where to obtain naloxone, how to request medication starts, which clinics offered low-threshold access, and what signs indicated non-opioid sedation. Good Samaritan protections were highlighted to encourage calls to emergency services. Campaigns that used plain language and avoided stigmatizing imagery improved help-seeking. Campaigns that focused on shock value achieved attention without durable behavior change. Special populations required tailored approaches. Adolescents encountered counterfeit pills through social circles and online marketplaces. Messaging for this group emphasized pill risk specifically and prioritized channels they actually used. Pregnant patients needed integrated obstetric and addiction care that avoided punitive responses and supported family stability. Older adults experienced interactions between prescribed sedatives, alcohol, and unrecognized opioid exposure. Primary care practices were encouraged to reconcile medications regularly and discuss risks explicitly. Indigenous communities and rural regions faced distance, workforce shortages, and historical distrust of institutions. Mobile clinics, community health representatives, and partnerships with tribal authorities improved access and cultural fit. LGBTQ+ communities benefited from peer-led services that understood minority stress, housing precarity, and discrimination patterns. The clinical playbook adapted to the pharmacology of the era. Low-dose buprenorphine initiation allowed transition from high-potency opioids without requiring full withdrawal. Divided dosing strategies addressed persistent symptoms. For individuals with repeated treatment failures, higher methadone doses and daily observed therapy improved retention. In rare cases where standard options failed and legal frameworks permitted, supervised injectable therapies reduced mortality and criminal involvement. Co-occurring disorders were treated actively rather than deferred. Untreated depression or PTSD routinely derailed progress in otherwise well-designed programs. Contingency management regained attention as a rigorously supported method for reinforcing attendance, negative toxicology, and goal behaviors. Small, immediate incentives produced outsized effects compared with delayed, abstract benefits. Programs that combined contingency management with medications and counseling produced higher retention than programs that used any single component alone. Concerns about cost and fraud were addressed through transparent rules, audits, and caps, allowing the method to scale responsibly. Law enforcement roles shifted in places that adopted health-first strategies. Officers carried naloxone and used it frequently. Referral pathways replaced citations in cases of simple possession. Corresponder models paired officers with clinicians and social workers to address behavior driven by illness rather than malice. Police departments that aligned metrics with harm reduction, overdose reversals, diversion to services, reductions in violent crime, reported improved public trust. Departments that defined success by arrest counts perpetuated cycles that consumed resources without reducing risk. Policy experiments proliferated. Some jurisdictions decriminalized possession for personal use, reallocating resources toward treatment and outreach. Others authorized supervised consumption sites under pilot authorities. Some expanded pharmacy-based naloxone access and allowed standing orders. Remote prescribing rules introduced during pandemic periods persisted in some places and were rolled back in others, with measurable effects on treatment uptake. Legal challenges shaped the pace of innovation. The most pragmatic programs persisted when results demonstrated fewer deaths, fewer infections, and stable neighborhoods. Symbolic programs faltered under the weight of constant crisis management. The private sector played a part. Pharmacies became critical nodes for naloxone, buprenorphine dispensing, and vaccine access for infections associated with injection use. Employers revised policies to support treatment leave and return to work pathways, recognizing that dismissal often led to instability that affected families and communities. Insurers adjusted coverage to include medications for opioid use disorder without burdensome prior authorization, expanding options beyond specialty clinics. Measurement clarified priorities. Programs tracked not only abstinence but also survival, retention, employment, school attendance, housing stability, and family reunification. Dashboards made outcomes visible to policymakers and the public. Funding followed effectiveness where political leadership accepted evidence even when it challenged old narratives. In other places, budgets remained tied to legacy programs without demonstrable impact, and conditions worsened despite the availability of better options. The synthetic era underscored the limits of slogans. "Just say no" did not account for dependence, grief, untreated mental illness, or an economy that left many without stable work. "Treatment only" did not address immediate poisoning risk or the reality of relapse in a contaminated market. "Enforcement only" failed to change supply dynamics and compounded inequity. The systems that held ground combined approaches, rapid, low-barrier access to medications, robust harm reduction, targeted enforcement against violence and trafficking, housing and employment supports, and straightforward messaging that taught practical skills. Three operational principles emerged repeatedly. First, speed matters. Every additional requirement between first contact and first dose lost people to a dangerous supply. Second, proximity matters. Services located near where people lived and used, delivered through mobile units, shelters, trusted community sites, achieved higher engagement. Third, dignity matters. Staff who spoke plainly, avoided moral lectures, and respected autonomy retained participants longer and saw better outcomes. Technology offered both risk and opportunity. Social media and messaging platforms expanded access to counterfeit pills and facilitated rapid distribution. The same channels, when used by public health and peer networks, spread alerts about high-risk batches and directed people to services. Overdose detection devices and smartphone apps created safety nets for those who insisted on using alone. Telehealth connected rural patients to specialists and reduced no-shows for urban patients navigating multiple obligations. Data analytics flagged clusters in near real time when privacy rules were understood and followed. The era also reframed the meaning of success. In a contaminated market, staying alive became the first and non-negotiable outcome. Success included months on medication without hospitalization, steady attendance at therapy, enrollment in an apprenticeship, a stable lease, or a child's school year completed without disruption. These were not lesser goals. They were prerequisites for deeper change. Programs that insisted on narrow measures lost participants and reported failure where a broader lens would have recorded progress worth defending. Critiques of harm reduction persisted, often rooted in fear that visible services would normalize drug use. Evidence from multiple jurisdictions indicated the opposite. When services reduced public use and syringe litter and prevented deaths on sidewalks and in restrooms, neighborhoods stabilized. Visibility of services did not correlate with increased initiation. It correlated with increased survival among those already using and with faster entry into treatment when readiness developed. Residents' concerns mattered and were addressed by setting clear performance targets for sites, publishing data, and convening forums where questions received specific answers rather than slogans. The synthetic era demanded new skills from frontline workers. Outreach staff learned to read the local supply, to identify signs of non-opioid sedation, to teach peers how to position bodies for airway protection, and to document reversals for community-level analysis. Clinicians learned microinduction, high-dose stabilization, and integrated treatment for co-occurring conditions rather than serial referral. Case managers learned housing systems, benefit eligibility, and employer partnerships. Supervisors built teams that could withstand vicarious trauma through peer support, predictable schedules, and mental health access. Families needed structured support rather than generic advice. Programs taught de-escalation, boundary setting, safe storage of medications, and overdose response. Caregivers received respite options. Siblings and children received age-appropriate explanations that neither minimized nor sensationalized. Courts and child welfare agencies coordinated with treatment providers to avoid punitive cycles that severed bonds unnecessarily. The combination of clear expectations and consistent support outperformed both permissive drift and reflexive punishment. The next phase of policy will likely continue to test competing models. Some regions will double down on punitive measures, despite repeated demonstrations of limited effectiveness in synthetic markets. Others will expand supervised consumption, safe supply pilots, and decriminalization, measuring results against explicit public health goals. Many will occupy a middle ground that blends enforcement against violent trafficking with expanded treatment and harm reduction. The record to date suggests that incremental, evidence-driven adjustments, sustained over years, outperform dramatic policy swings. At street level, the questions remain practical. Is naloxone within arm's reach? Are rescue breaths taught and practiced? Is a same-day pathway to medication available without complex paperwork or multiple appointments? Are housing and employment supports aligned with treatment schedules? Can individuals move between levels of care without repeating intake every time? Do dashboards show where gaps persist, and can leaders adjust budgets accordingly? Each affirmative answer increases the probability that the next call to emergency services will not be a death. The synthetic era closed any remaining debate about whether addiction policy can rely on a single lever. Markets adapt too fast for enforcement to operate alone. Suffering runs too deep for treatment to begin with a lecture. Death arrives too quickly for perfection to be the criterion for help. The systems that save lives treat survival as the foundation, respect autonomy, and insist on measurable performance. Those systems do not promise a world without drugs. They build a world with fewer funerals, more stability, and more opportunities for people to choose differently tomorrow than they chose today. This is the measure by which communities can judge their response. If fewer parents bury children, if fewer children enter foster care due to preventable deaths, if fewer workers are lost to overdose at home or on a break, if fewer emergency rooms see repeat visits from the same addresses, then the response is aligned with reality. If those numbers move the other way, rhetoric is outpacing results. The synthetic era makes that accounting unavoidable. It remains possible to assemble a response that meets it with competence and steadiness. The tools are known. The work is procedural rather than dramatic. Where leaders set aside spectacle and invest in procedures that match the era's risks, the curve bends toward survival.